The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Graham, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now, including a story about what George Washington really looked like. First President of the United States, Dave, don't we have portraits of him?
There are lots of portraits of him. In fact, there are so many representations of George Washington. He's even on our dollar bill. So George Washington is everywhere. But the one thing we don't have of George Washington is an actual photograph. So in all these portraits, we really have to take for granted that the artist's style accurately represented these pre-photography people.
So which artists are we looking at? Are we looking at portraits or sculpture or what?
Well, Rob, the artist the researchers focused on in this study was Gilbert Stuart, who was a very famous 19th century painter. He painted six of the American presidents and a lot of other famous individuals from his time. And the interesting thing about Gilbert Stuart is a few of the subjects that he painted, for example, President John Quincy Adams and Senator Daniel Webster, were actually alive during the time when photography had just been invented. So in addition to paintings we have that Stuart made, we actually also have real photographs of these men. And what the scientists wondered in this study is they said, well, can we use these painting photograph combinations as a sort of Rosetta Stone to figure out what Stuart's artistic style was? And then can we subtract that style from a lot of the early portraits of these famous men and get a better picture of what these guys actually look like?
So assuming that Stuart's style didn't change over the course of his life, subtracting away the style from George Washington's portrait.
Exactly. And what the researchers noticed when they started to look at these photographs and compared them with Stuart's paintings is that Stuart tended to give his subjects a bit fuller cheeks and he gave them higher eyebrows. Some really subtle things, but things that definitely marked his artistic signature. And what the researchers did was they fed these pictures and representations of these photographs into a computer. They created an algorithm that helped subtract out his style, and voila, they came up with what they say is a pretty close representation of George Washington and some other famous folks, including Washington's contemporary John Adams. And of course, you can see these pictures on the site.
So obviously, there had to be at least some extrapolation here because these photographs weren't taken at the same time as the portraits were painted, were they?
That's a good point, Rob. The person wasn't necessarily the same age in the photographs as he was in the painting, so it's not perfect. But what the researchers want to do is they really want to refine this method. And it's actually, as you can imagine, very, very difficult to track down these very early photographs. And they've actually set up a website, which you can also check out on the site, where people can submit very old photographs. And what this team is going to try to do is match these old photographs, especially if they're famous folks, obviously that makes it easier, to portraits and further refine their technique so that they can correct for things like age and really try to get as close as we're probably ever going to get to a photograph of these pre-photography people.
Okay. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Robin, this next story, I've got a very cool physics trick for you that you can try next time you're at a party or at least a party of science nerds.
What's the trick?
Well, Rob, take two tin cans and one of them has no top or bottom. So it's essentially a tube and the other one just has a top. Now take both of these cans and put them in a box of sand so that their bottom rims are right on top of the sand.
So the one that's not a tube, it's closed off at the top.
Exactly. Now what I want you to do, assuming you had some sand in front of you, is try to push both of these cans down at the same time. Just try to really shove them into the sand. And what you'll notice, rather surprisingly, is that the can with the top actually goes into the sand much easier than the tube. And you wouldn't expect that. You would expect all this sort of air pressure in the can with the top to be preventing you, sort of like a diving bell in the water would be preventing you from pushing it down. But actually, it has a much easier time of going in. And if you don't believe me, there's a video on the site. You can actually watch this happening.
So this is a party trick with a bunch of science geeks at a beach.
That's true. The beach would be the best place to do it.
So what's going on?
Well, Rob, it took a team of physicists to find out. They were actually the ones that came up with the trick in the first place, too. And what they found out after a lot of intense physical analysis was that what happens with the closed-ended cylinder is it affects the sand in a very unusual way. Ordinarily, sand acts very much like a solid. But if the air around the sand grains moves quickly enough, the sand starts to flow like a fluid. And so what the researchers are saying is happening with this trick is that the air that's trapped in this can with the top rushes out from beneath the cylinder's rim when you start to push it down into the sand, and it effectively fluidizes the sand. It turns the sand almost into a liquid, and you don't get that effect with the can that's just a tube. And therefore, the can with the top is actually meeting a lot less resistance and has a lot easier time sinking into the sand than the other can does.
Now, you said there was a video on the site, but I can imagine that there's going to be all kinds of people trying this out at beaches around the world. It works every time?
Well, Rob, you've got to set this up just right. The sand has to be pretty densely packed. And also, you've got to push these cans down very quickly. If you don't do that, the air will slowly seep away from the can with the top, and that'll essentially make it no different than the can that's the tube. So there are some conditions you've got to watch out for. But if you can get it right, chances are you're going to really impress your friends, at least if they're physics geeks.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from slamming cans into sand to slamming meteorites into dirt, this last story is about all of the various objects that have impacted Earth over the last few thousand years and how they might pose a greater danger than we thought.
Is there some new data to suggest more danger?
There is, and it actually has to do with this impact that researchers discovered a couple of years ago in the southwest corner of Egypt. There's a crater there that's about 45 meters wide that's called the Kamil Crater. And researchers first started studying it about a year ago. They found it actually during a Google Earth survey. It was big enough to be detected on Google Earth. And when they first started analyzing it, they found a lot of fragments of the original meteorite that had caused the crater. And in this new study, what they did was they started really analyzing these fragments. They found that this was an iron meteorite and that the meteorite probably weighed about 9.1 metric tons, which means that before it actually slammed into Earth, it was probably 20 to 40 metric tons. That's because objects tend to break apart a lot when they enter our atmosphere. Now, that may seem like a big meteorite, but it's actually relatively small compared to a lot of the meteorites that have hit Earth and done a lot of damage. What's interesting about it is that the fact that the researchers found a meteorite this small that had still caused a crater. They used to think that these small meteorites just disintegrated essentially in Earth's atmosphere, means that these guys are actually hitting Earth, could be hitting Earth a lot more than scientists thought. In fact, they used to think that the proportion of these objects that actually would strike Earth was only about one quarter of them would actually strike Earth. Now, with this new find, they're saying as many as a third of these objects actually might not disintegrate in the atmosphere and strike Earth. And what that means is not only do we have to worry about all the big meteorites that might hit us, we have to worry about these small ones as well, because the atmosphere may not protect us as well as we thought.
So the more craters you find, the statistical probability goes up even more.
Exactly, especially the more craters you find associated with these small meteorites, because we already knew these big meteorites could cause craters because they were obviously hitting the Earth, but we didn't know that with the small ones. So if we start to find a lot of these small craters, which we might do with Google Earth and with other techniques, scientists could find out it may even be more than a third of these meteorites are actually hitting Earth, which would mean the sky is falling even more than we thought before.
But still, the occurrence of a meteorite actually striking Earth is incredibly rare, isn't
it? It is very rare. And so even though these researchers are upping the odds that one of these things is going to hit us and do some damage, the odds of it hitting us in the first place is still very, very small.
Okay. Whew. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about new insights into how the Grand Canyon was formed and also some new insights into prostate cancer. Researchers have completed the prostate cancer genome, and that's telling them a lot about how this disease progresses and potentially even new ways to treat it. And for Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we're going to take an in-depth look at the budget for science agencies. A lot of new numbers are going to be released on Monday. And we're going to be tracking that very closely to figure out which agencies are most affected, what that means for researchers, what it means for funding and grants, and even the creation of new scientific centers. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.